Live from Studio S here at WKAR's Current State, Hank Horton on bass, Arlene McDaniel on piano, and Rob Killips on trombone. Live music today for Live Music Friday by the Friday Jazz Lunch Bunch. This trio's performing every Friday at Marshall Music in Lansing, and it's free. You can bring your lunch, listen to some live jazz. We'll be hearing more from the trio and about the Friday Jazz Lunch Series at Marshall later in the hour. Glad you can be with us here today. Coming up later in the program here, learn more about the MSU Bee Palooza, everything you ever wanted to know about honeybees, bumblebees, and the dozens of species of bees that are native just to Michigan, which I'm not sure I knew until I started looking into this segment. We have dozens of species of bees. I can think of two. We have dozens. Learn more coming up later this hour here on Current State. At the top of our program, voters in East Lansing may decide whether to alter policy involving the city's attorneys. Two East Lansing activists claim the city could save money and avoid potential conflicts of interest by hiring a full-time municipal lawyer. The East Lansing City Council already has that option, but often opts to contract legal work hourly to private firms. Petitioners have obtained more than 2,000 signatures that could give voters the chance to force the City Council to do just that. The petitions picked up some influential opponents as well, including former East Lansing mayors Sam Singh and Mark Meadows. They both contend that activists Jeff Hank and Phil Belfi are wrong about how much the move would save. Here to talk about his petition, attorney and candidate for U.S. Congress, Jeff Hank.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Welcome back to Current State.
Thank you.
You are stressing that the city is wasting money by not hiring a staff attorney and that this arrangement invites conflict of interest. Can you expand on those for us just a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, we should make it very clear here that we turned in 2,269 signatures for a charter amendment in the city of East Lansing, which is roughly 8 or 9% of registered voters at those numbers. So of all those thousands of people who support this measure, everyone has different reasons why they want to do this. One of the reasons that we're proposing is that we believe it could be a cost savings to the city. We don't really know for sure what it costs to do this, but I have comparative data from other cities, which the opponents so far have failed to pick up on or really discuss. But a cost issue is not the only issue. It's about conflicts of interest. It's about the idea that we have officials who are accountable to the people. It's about the idea that we're investing money in our own government rather than into a private business. And it's about a philosophical idea that someone who exercises one of the most important government functions, which is prosecution, shouldn't be a private person. This is one of the most core functions of government. And you look at, we elect a county prosecutor, we elect our judges, we elect our city council members. Why is it that the one official that we don't have some more control over, that is a private person, is our city attorney? So that's the basis for it. Comparative cities like Traverse City, Ann Arbor, Jackson, Lansing, Kalamazoo all have in-house city attorneys. So what this proposal really does is it changes the charter language so that the city will have a legal department, that the city attorney will be an employee of the city, they're currently not, and that the city attorneys will work exclusively for the city and not for anyone else. That's the petition in a nutshell. A lot of the opposition is off track on what they're trying to come up with.
But you do acknowledge it may not save the city any money.
We don't know.
That's possible.
It's possible, but the statistics that we have from other cities tend to suggest that it may not be. And part of the problem is that we don't really know what the city attorney's office costs us every year. The budget is somewhat opaque on this issue, but the recent East Lansing budget has it at about $479,000 a year. Now, I've heard from former council members, city council members in East Lansing, that may go up to $1 million a year some years. We don't know. We don't have all the facts. But the important part of this is it's a citizen initiative, and we're going to have that discussion over the next couple of months here. And cost is but one issue that the people in East Lansing get to decide on this.
You're alleging a lack of transparency as far as the costs go and how this money is spent as well?
Absolutely.
Well, a number of skeptics, among them former Mayor Mark Meadows, have responded that you're citing the cost. You have cited the cost of one attorney, and you're overlooking the cost of paying a full legal department. Does that account for your uncertainty here as far as whether or not this will save any money?
No. I mean, to be attacked by Mark Meadows and Sam Singh, whose legacy in East Lansing is blighting the downtown and putting people into debt and failing to stand up for civil liberties is a badge of honor. You know, you look at Traverse City, for example, as an in-house city attorney, they spend $139,000 a year. Jackson spends $416,000 a year with a population of about 33,000. So comparable cities are doing this for different amounts of money, and I believe that we could do that similarly, and it's something that needs to be looked at.
How is it a badge of honor to be opposed by people in the community who really have an awful lot of supporters who helped lead the city for so many years, Sam Singh and Mark Meadows?
Well, they're in the minority here, Mark. The people that we talked to on the street are overwhelmingly in support of this, and I'm being personally attacked. Typically, when someone makes an ad hominem attack against someone, it suggests that the merits of their argument are weak. You know, they fail to mention that current council member Ruth Beyer signed the petition. They fail to mention that my congressional opponent Eric Schertzing signed this petition. They fail to mention that former council member Don Power signed the petition, that former congressional candidate Bob Alexander signed the petition, that a lot of attorneys signed the petition, that a lot of prominent educated professors and people in the city all signed this petition. So if they want to attack me and have disdain and contempt for a democratic process, they're also insulting everyone else. If they think that the voters of East Lansing are so stupid that they would be misled by me or someone else, then I think that sort of shows the contempt, elitism, and arrogance that is so demonstrative in our public officials these days. And this is one of the reasons I'm running for office. I want to be a champion of the people. And I don't think Meadows or Singh is doing that.
We're talking with attorney and activist Jeff Hank about his petition that would alter East Lansing's policy involving city attorneys. Now, Mark Meadows specifically claims to have visited this very issue when he was mayor. He strongly suggests it's more complicated than you've made it sound.
Well, I'd encourage him to release his data. I want to have a conversation with him. His report that he's talking about is 16 years old. Mark Meadows' statement the other day was quite bizarre. He actually accuses me of being a Tea Party member and of apparently not being a Democrat, which is funny because I've been a member of the Democratic Party since I was 18 years old in high school.
Where did he get that? This was a Facebook post.
I don't know, but the fact of the matter is Mark Meadows is actually not a member of the Michigan Democratic Party. So I don't know where this misinformation is coming from. I suspect of it's a lot of it is personal. It's kind of trying to protect a legacy and it's trying to protect a cronyism. But this is, I think Meadows and Sam Singh are in the minority on this. And, you know, we'll see. The voters will decide.
You're saying that Mark Meadows is not a Democrat?
He's not a member of the Michigan Democratic Party as of about a week ago. So I don't know where he gets his information from, but I think he needs to have a reality check. And his own statement says he doesn't know what we told people on the street. Well, why would you suggest that we were dishonest with people without checking with us and admitting that you don't know what we told people? And again, if he doesn't trust the discernment of the thousands of people that signed this petition, it's this out-of-touch sort of elitism that I think is a huge problem in politics today, because I trust the voters in East Lansing to make the right decision.
A city manager, George Lahanas, commented to the state news that the petition, your petition, would appear to remove an option that's already open to the city council. You don't deny that, do you? I mean, that is an option already open to city council. They just don't avail themselves of that option, correct?
The current charter allows for the creation of a legal department. And what we want to do is we want to mandate it. And the city council can still hire outside legal counsel on a case-by-case basis when they need it.
You've been involved in legal actions against the city in the past. You've been unsuccessful on more than one occasion. Is this petition effort fueled at all by those unsuccessful efforts?
No, I've also been successful many times. This petition effort, again, is not just me. Thousands of people sign this. Just because I'm the spearhead and leader on this, I'm going to take some flack and I'm going to take some bullying, intimidation, and retaliation. I can deal with that. That's what I do. But, you know, to sort of ignore the fact that thousands of other people sign this and try to attack me personally shows that these officials who are in the minority are desperate.
I mean, you were sanctioned at least once for the frivolous nature of a legal action. Mr. Belfi was unsuccessful in a bid for city council.
I have been
relevant,
sanctioned, but I disagree 100% that it was frivolous if you look at the actual facts of the case.
Talk to us more about Mr. Meadows' claim that you've billed yourself as a Tea Partier.
It's bizarre, and he claimed this is a publicity stunt, that I'm doing this for name recognition. The fact of the matter is this has been going on for over a year. This petition was in place long before I was running for office. I don't know why he's calling me a Tea Partier again. you know, I'm running as a progressive Democrat who supports, you know, EPA regulation of carbon. I support marriage equality. I support free college tuition along the lines of Redeeming America's Promise, which former Governor Blanchard came out the other day. I support rebuilding the space program. Those aren't typical Tea Party positions. I don't really know what exactly is meant by the Tea Party label. If it's to suggest that I am not a fan of government debt or abusive government, then I'll take that, absolutely. But I've also seen polls that suggest one in four Democrats identify with the Tea Party. And as someone who's running for Congress, you know, my goal is to represent all the constituents in this district. So I will listen to Tea Party members, and when they have good ideas, I'll adopt them. And I think that's part of the problem with politicians like Mark Meadows is that he's out of touch with people. And he's sitting here on his Facebook page making representations and admitting that he hasn't really done his homework and investigation into it. He could have called us. So I want to touch on that salary issue real quick. What we put out was a statement saying that the city of Jackson pays their city attorney $112,000. The city of Jackson city of Lansing pays $130,000. Those are salaries. They don't include benefits. But when you add up the different budgets for these different cities, I can give you another example. Kalamazoo, population of 75,000. In-house city attorney, they spend about $709,000 a year. They have four attorneys and two secretaries on staff. That includes their benefits. So the point of this is that the citizens in East Lansing get to decide this. We need to have a discussion. We need the facts to come out. Cost is not the only issue. When we're out talking to people on the streets, we're very honest with people. We don't need to tell people, you know, some falsehood. Mark Meadows actually referred to it as BS. The fact of the matter is, when we would approach people on the street, most people would already have a gripe one reason or another with the city attorney's office or with the city government in East Lansing, and they more than willingly signed our petition. I would say that about 95% of the people we asked who were registered East Lansing voters signed it, and most of those indicated they would be supportive of it. Some of those said they simply believe in the democratic process and want to give people an opportunity to vote. So again, I think these guys are in the minority, and they're protecting their past legacy, which, you know, we're going to hopefully change.
Are you campaigning much in your eighth district bid?
Every single day. I mean, my goal is to create an American renaissance. I believe that this country has so much opportunity. We're not realizing it. We elect politicians like Meadows instead of statesmen. I aim to be a statesman. I aim to represent this country and all the interests of the constituents in this country. We are failing. We are behind when it comes to quality of life indexes. I want America to be a leader. I want us to be this shining city on the hill that leads by example. I want us to be a leader in green technology. I want us to be a leader in education.
Is there a centerpiece to this renaissance?
Well, the centerpiece is a renaissance in all things, whether that's political discourse, again, whether that's leading in alternative energy or education, and that's electing statesmen and stateswomen, people who want good policy, people who are honest and authentic and care about this country and who are not interested in just in fundraising or two-year election cycles, self-interest, short-term. We need to think long-term. We need to think generationally. And again, it's having America be a leader. We're the greatest country in the world, but we are not leading when it comes to things like even our – we're the 30th in internet speed and about 28th or so when it comes to access to the internet. We need to invest in the future infrastructure of this country, whether that's electrical grids, infrastructure. I mean, you look at the state legislature, Mark. The number one thing I heard on the street from everybody of all political persuasions was fix the roads. Now, we just had the state legislature, so dysfunctional, go on a summer break without even getting road legislation done. And I can tell you that my belief on this is that you have some Democrats who don't want to do a road deal because they don't want Governor Snyder and the Republicans to have credit for it come election time in November. And you have Republicans who want to put it off because they want to do a deal closer to election time so they can take credit for it. But this is the kind of politics that is bad for us. We should be concerned about good policy and getting things done. We can't even fix the roads. That's how bad things are.
It's been over 6 months since voters in Lansing legalized small amounts of marijuana for people 21 and over on private property. You drove that successful effort. Have you seen any impact from that?
We have. In fact, we've heard from lots of people that they've had positive interactions with the city of Lansing police. We've heard positive statements from the Lansing government. This year, we've inspired about 18 other cities in the state of Michigan to pass similar initiatives. There are citizens' initiatives going on all over this state. It's going to be a green revolution in some ways. People are tired of bad policy, and if our politicians aren't going to lead, the people are going to do it, and I'm very happy to be part of that.
Jeff Hank is an East Lansing attorney and activist, candidate for the Democratic nod for the 8th Congressional District primary, and he's involved in a petition effort to alter East Lansing's policy involving city attorneys. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
the Friday Jazz Lunch Bunch here on Current State, live from Studio S at WKAR. Hank Horton, Arlene McDaniel, and Rob Killips. You can catch them every Friday during the noon hour at Marshall Music in Lansing. We'll be visiting with the players here in just a little bit and hearing more from them as well. It's Current State on WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Well, it was inevitable that we'd catch the buzz about Bee-palooza. The Bee Education event is this Sunday at MSU's Horticulture Demonstration Gardens. But why do we need education about bees anyway? Well, joining us now to talk bee issues is MSU Professor of Entomology Rufus Isaacs. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning.
In layman's terms, could you give us a brief idea of what you study? Are you, you're a bee specialist then?
Well, we are doing some work in my lab here at MSU on bees and pollination. We also study pest management and generally work with issues related to agriculture in terms of insects. And bees are so essential to Michigan's agriculture that we're now doing quite a bit of work on those pollinators.
And what is Bee-palooza? What happens?
So Bee-palooza is this event that is an outreach event that's here at MSU. It's our third time doing this now, so this has been a really popular addition to the activities we have during the year. This year, on Sunday, 1 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we'll have a whole host of different educational programs going there at the demonstration gardens here on campus at Bogue Road and Wilson at the intersection there. You can find the gardens. And we have, I think, 7 educational stations set up so people can learn about all the different kinds of bees that are in Michigan. They can learn about honeybees and see a demonstration hive where they can look inside and see the queen and see the bees dancing and working inside the hive. We also have a company here in Michigan that raises bumblebees commercially for pollinating tomatoes inside greenhouses. They're here in the state of Michigan, and so we've brought them in, and they actually have a what they call a petting zoo for bumblebees. So they have. Now, most people might not really want to touch a bumblebee, but it turns out that male bumblebees don't have stingers. Only the females have them. So they sort out a whole load of male bumblebees, and the kids love it because they can come along and stick their hand inside this container, and they get to pet these fuzzy bumblebees without any risk of being stung.
How interesting. I'm sure you would say that informing the general public about the role of bees is pretty important. More important that people understand the role of bees than all kinds of other insects, I would imagine.
Well,
given their role as pollinators.
Their role is very important. And obviously most people, they know honeybees and they understand that, you know, honeybees live in these colonies and that they get moved around by beekeepers and that they get honey from them. People may not be as aware that those honeybees also provide a huge amount of pollination to our state. We have the largest tart cherry industry in the nation and the largest blueberry industry in the nation, and those crops and apples and cucumbers and all sorts of other crops require these bees to visit the flowers when the flowers are open in the spring. And from their movement of the pollen, we get the delicious fruits at the end of the year. So you can look at Michigan's economy and add up easily to $400 million of crop and honey production that is provided by this service that we get from bees.
What's the status of colony collapse disorder right now?
Well, there is a survey that's done every year, and the last survey that was done for the last winter estimated about 23% colony loss overall, which, you know, if you think about any...
From when to when?
So that was through the winter of 2013 into 14. And obviously, it was a very tough winter for this part of the nation.
But that's quite a loss for one season, though.
Yeah, and that's an average across the nation. It was less of a loss than they'd had the previous year, which is encouraging across the country that there's maybe a little less of the concern. But regionally, I think within Michigan, because we had such a cold winter, there were reports of higher losses. And 65% of those respondents to that survey said that they had more loss than they do on average. So if you think about any other agricultural commodity, if you were to lose, you know, you lose that proportion of your animals, it would be a grave concern.
Is that what's triggering the formation of a company like the commercial bumblebee company you mentioned a minute ago? Are these companies being formed to compensate for any lack of pollination that we're losing because of colony collapse disorder?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that company has been in existence for a long time and predates colony collapse disorder.
Okay.
And they, as I said earlier, they specialize on giving bumblebees or selling bumblebees to companies that are raising indoor crops like tomatoes, and honeybees don't work very well indoors. But they're also seeing an expansion in their industry for using these bumblebees out of doors. And I think that's partly because people are interested in trying to not put all their eggs in one basket and maybe diversifying the way that they get their crop pollinated by using maybe honeybees and bumblebees and trying to enhance these native bees that are here in the state.
Our guest is MSU Professor of Entomology Rufus Isaacs. We're talking about Sunday's Bee Palooza here at Michigan State University, 1 till 4 at MSU's Horticulture Demonstration Gardens. If colony collapse disorder were to worsen, Rufus, our human attempts to supplement the process by harvesting bees, could we compensate for that? Or is there a point at which we could not? Do we know that?
Well, there is concern that the total number of honeybee colonies in the nation is getting towards the point where there may not be enough to do all of the work, particularly in almonds. Almonds is a big crop in California, and we have honeybee hives from Michigan that go to California in the spring around February, March to pollinate almonds. And that is a huge crop and is expanding. And because of that, there's more and more demand, and the price of rental fees that the growers pay to the beekeepers has gone up because of supply and demand. So there is concern that if that almond industry keeps expanding, you know, the question is raised, will we have enough honeybee colonies to meet that demand? But in the spring, because we get to bloom fairly late in Michigan during the annual cycle, usually in May and June for these big fruit crops, by then we get the bees back and they're healthy and they're ready to pollinate here in Michigan.
You've done work highlighting secondary pollinators. The article on the MSU website had the title Plan B, B-E-E, which was clever. I understand that these are the second string species that can also pollinate. Can you talk to us about some of those?
So as I said earlier, most people know honeybees and they might know bumblebees fairly well. But
the wind can pollinate.
Wind
crops,
pollinates
correct?
A lot of plants. So if you look at grasses and trees, many of them use wind to move their pollen around. But there are many plants, and a lot of them are fruit and vegetable crops, where the wind doesn't do the job, and so they need something to move it around. And it's often bees, it might be birds, bats pollinate some plants too. But these insects have adapted with the plants to move the pollen, and in return they get some nectar as a reward.
Can the average homeowner do, I imagine there are steps the average homeowner can take to keep bees in their backyard healthy? What would those be?
That's a big part of Bee Palooza. We'll be talking about practices such as planting native plants and a combination of flowering plants that will bloom through the season so that bees have something to feed on all through the summer. We'll also be talking about nesting habitat that people can create in their back garden for these solitary native bees, which are very docile. They're more focused on getting the pollen and nectar than worrying about people. So, yes, there's a lot that gardeners can do, and we're really trying to highlight these practices to that audience because they can do a lot in urban environments to support bees.
To clarify for us one more time, how many different species of bees are there in Michigan?
So far, we're up above 400 in terms of the number of species.
Oh, it's even more than I thought. I alluded to dozens of species.
Many dozens.
It's even more, many, many dozens.
Yeah. We have somebody in the lab here at MSU, Jason Gibbs, who's looking into this, and he's looking at historical records and collections right now, and we're up to 440 or so species.
That is just amazing. Just amazing. MSU Professor of Entomology Rufus Isaacs, we've been talking about Bee Palooza Sunday, 1 till 4 p.m., lots of things for kids, but lots for adults to learn as well at MSU's Horticulture Demonstration Gardens. Dr. Isaacs, thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. The history of 20th century design in Michigan isn't just about automobiles. After World War II, Michigan was a hub for architects who broke away from the neoclassical shapes inspired by ancient Greece and Rome. The era of modern architecture lasted about 30 years and produced many structures still seen today. A symposium in Grand Rapids this weekend seeks to study Michigan's role in modern architecture, and Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to talk about the event. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Mark. The Kendall College of Art and Design is hosting the symposium. A program called Michigan Modern celebrates our state's design heritage from buildings to furniture. I met up with Brian Conway to talk about modern architecture. He's the State Historic Preservation Officer. We met in East Lansing at the headquarters of the Michigan State Medical Society. When you enter the lobby, you feel as though you've stepped onto the set of Mad Men. It just screams 1961. Brian Conway and I sat down on authentic leather chairs, and he explained Michigan's key role in the era of modernism.
There were certain things that were happening in Michigan that just were not happening anywhere else in the country. Of course, we had the auto industry, which was booming in the post-World War II era. We had, on the west side of the state, we had the furniture industry. We had just outstanding educational institutions, such as the University of Michigan Architecture Program and the Cranbrook College of Art in Bloomfield Hills. All of these things together with the money that was coming into the state at that time attracted a lot of young design talent. So Michigan became a center of design in those post-war era. The Taubman College of Architecture at the University of Michigan was one of the first architectural programs in the country to look at modernism, whereas other architecture programs were still kind of stuck in the classical mode, looking back to historical precedents in architecture. At the same time, the students that were attracted to Cranbrook were making their own name in the design world. Charles Eames, for example, and Errol Saarinen and others were entering into design competitions, caught the national attention, and kind of started their career as what would become later outstanding designers, both in architecture and industrial design.
I think a lot of people could probably pick out a modern architectural building without even knowing that it's called that. What are some elements that make a structure modern architecture from that period in history?
The philosophy that developed in what we today call modern architecture or mid-century modern was a philosophy of moving away from any historical or classical detailing. So most buildings will be very simple, plain, very straightforward, very geometric. Very clean, use of new and innovative materials, a lot of glass, wide open spaces, open floor plans, those kinds of things.
We are right now sitting in a beautiful example of modern architecture. This is the Michigan State Medical Society building. It was built in 1961 by one of the most famous architects of that period, Minoru Yamasaki.
He was based in Troy, Michigan. He actually came to Michigan because of the synergy of design that was occurring in Michigan that I mentioned earlier. He was attracted to the other architects that were working here. He actually came and worked for Errol Saarinen for a while, then branched out on his own. He became very well known for what we might call today New Formalism, which is kind of a subcategory of modernism. And this particular building here is just an outstanding example of that New Formalism. We're very fortunate that the Michigan Medical Society has done an outstanding job of maintaining this building. You walk into it today and it's like walking back into the 50s. It really has not been altered significantly at all. They do a wonderful job of maintaining the building.
When you drive by on Saginaw, you see immediately there are 31 semi-cylindrical cast concrete arch sections. It's extremely distinctive and very striking.
Yes. Yamasaki, like other architects of that period, he was looking at new and innovative materials, concrete being one of them, precast forms. He was also experimenting a lot with kind of stylized naturalistic forms. That's why you see the curves. He would apply them in a very formal manner so that, like you say, you have the repetition. The building originally was pretty much symmetrical, which is unusual for a modern building. So he has his own distinctive style. Very few architects actually picked up on that style, so usually his buildings are very distinctive. Another very good example in Michigan is his consolidated gas building, now known as One Woodward in downtown Detroit, which is another excellent example of a building that really has not been altered a great deal. We also are fortunate to have the McGregor Memorial Center on Wayne State University campus. I think probably one have recognized as perhaps one of his most outstanding buildings, a real gem of a building. And we're very fortunate, most recently, Wayne State University restored the reflecting pools around the McGregor Center. So once again, after many years of dormancy, we have the entire architectural design complete now with those pools restored. It's beautiful.
And of course, the work that he may be most famous for on an international scale is the former World Trade Center, the Twin Towers.
Yes, exactly. And some will say that One Woodward Avenue was kind of the jumping off point for him to get the commission for the World Trade Center. And we see a lot of the, or some of the detailing in Woodward Avenue you could pick up in the World Trade Center.
The symposium that takes place begins on Friday in Grand Rapids at the Kendall College of Art and Design, speaks to Michigan's architectural past and its legacy. What are some of the key topics that will be discussed?
Well, through the State Historic Preservation Office, we realized that there was a story to be told about Michigan's role in the development of modernism. So we worked to put together a symposium. This is actually the second symposium we've held. We held one last year at Cranbrook. And both this year and last year, the symposium is coupled with a major exhibition. This year it's occurring at the Grand Rapids Art Museum. The full title is Michigan Modern, Design That Shaped America. So the intent with the symposium is to, of course, encourage people to come and see the exhibition, but also then to hear national speakers talking about various topics related to Michigan's design history. We have speakers talking about the fiberglass boat industry, which developed again in Michigan, which made boating available to the everyman as fiberglass boats became more affordable than wooden boats. And that kind of followed the pattern of the auto industry on the southeast side of the state. We have, of course, discussions about the furniture industry that was occurring in West Michigan. We're fortunate that we have the home of the Herman Miller Corporation, as well as factories from Knoll here in Michigan. So we have just an outstanding heritage of iconic modern furniture design. And we'll actually be conducting tours of the Herman Miller facilities in Zeeland. We will be actually going into the facility where they manufacture the iconic Eames lounge chair. So there's a lot of really exciting things that are just once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to experience.
You're listening to Current State. We're talking with Brian Conway, the State Historic Preservation Officer. And you touched upon this just now, Brian, with the tours of the Herman Miller facility. Architectural tourism, how key is that in Michigan? And to what degree is Michigan really on the landscape of people who want to come here just for the joy of seeing all these great designs?
Well, I think there is a market for architectural tourism. We certainly see that. And this is also one of the reasons we wanted to get involved with this story of modernism in Michigan, because we felt that it was an underappreciated or underestimated resource here in Michigan. We knew that there was this story. We also saw, from the historic preservation point of view, we saw buildings from this period being threatened. Typically, when a building becomes 50, 60 years old, it either needs a major infusion of rehabilitation or it's a candidate for demolition and replacement. So we knew that one of the first aspects of historic preservation is to provide some understanding of that architectural period. And this period is 50, 60, 70 years old. It's coming of age, and if we're not careful, we're going to be losing some of these magnificent masterpieces like the such as where we're sitting today.
Is Michigan still a leader in architecture? We've now exceeded the postmodernism period. Does this state still have a future when it comes to design?
Definitely. Michigan does have a very strong design industry that grew out of this period. And I think that it's another reason we wanted to tell the stories. I think it goes unrecognized. People often think of New York or Los Angeles, but they don't think of the Midwest or particularly Michigan. But there is, because of these early industries that are still thriving in Michigan, there's a very strong design industry that's grown out of that. So yes, part of our goal in this whole project is to recognize that history and tell the rest of the world that there is a very strong design industry still existing and thriving and very successful here in Michigan.
Brian Conway is the State Historic Preservation Officer for the state of Michigan. Brian, it's been a pleasure to sit in this remarkable building and talk about this fascinating period of history.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been delightful.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery. And one more note about Minoru Yamasaki. As I mentioned in the interview, Mark, he was a very celebrated architect who was best known for designing the World Trade Center. He died in 1986, so he did not live to see the Twin Towers destroyed on 9/11. He did, however, see that happen to one of his greatest creations. Back in the early 1950s, Yamasaki designed the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex in St. Louis, Missouri. It was hailed at the time as the solution to the city's overcrowded slums. It was a series of 33 very stark concrete buildings, each 11 stories high. But almost from the start, it became a crime and drug-infested monstrosity of smashed windows and broken lives.
So Pruitt-Igoe was more than modern architecture then. It was a failed social experiment.
That's right. It never lived up to the promises that were made to St. Louis's poor in the 50s. So tragically, what was really the first significant project of Minoru Yamasaki's career became an icon of urban decay, and Pruitt-Igoe was finally demolished in 1972.
Today is demolition day at Pruitt-Igoe. Here in the late afternoon, with weather moving in from the west and helicopters hovering above, Door Wrecking Company will explode the supporting columns from an 11-story vacant high-rise. Part one of a study to determine if these buildings can be reshaped into a better environment for people. And not only St. Louis, but the rest of the nation is viewing with great interest the results of this experiment.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Our live music here today on Live Music Friday, live from Studio S, provided by the Friday Jazz Lunch Bunch. Hank Horton on bass, Arlene McDaniel on piano, and Rob Killips on trombone. Here's the band with Body and Soul. Thank you. Body and Soul. It's the Friday Jazz Lunch Bunch here on WKAR's Current State. It's coming to you live from Studio S here on 90.5. Hank Horton on bass, Arlene McDaniel on piano, and Rob Killips on trombone. You can hear these players do it again today during the noon hour. The whole idea is that these three play at Marshall Music every Friday, and we welcome them to our microphones here now. Is this your first season doing the Friday thing at Marshall's, Hank?
It is. We started 2 weeks ago just to kind of get our feet wet, and now we're ready to go public.
And you rehearsals are over. It's showtime. You've been at Marshall's for quite a few years. What do you do there?
I've been at Marshall's. Well, I came back to the city here a couple years ago. I've been teaching at Marshall's for about a year. Last few months, I became the director of the School of Music at Marshall. So we're trying to recruit new students, and we're doing an outreach program to all the schools. And this is part of that, too, because we're featuring local talent, national talent, and now and then we're featuring some of our very talented students that we have at the School of Music.
Sounds great. Rob, you've played around the world. You've lived in London. You've played with Blur. You also lived and played in Puerto Rico. What's that been like?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been amazing, Mark. I mean, I've spent the last 20-odd years as a professional musician, and I've been really fortunate to have toured in 47 different countries. As you mentioned, I lived in London for the better part of the 90s. It's been great. I moved back to the States in the early 2000s, and I've been pretty busy ever since.
Can you be a hired gun? I mean, you've obviously enjoyed success as a hired gun, so to speak, a hired gun trombone player. I mean,
correct.
If you play a horn, you can carve a career out of that.
Well, it's,
you've done it.
Yeah, I've done it, and it hasn't been easy. Certainly, it's a struggle, and there are a lot of things that you have to resign yourself to the fact that you're going to travel, which is fine. I mean, that's part of the gig, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So the majority of my work is in the Detroit area. I commute to Detroit usually 3-4 times a week.
Wow. Okay. Arlene, you were on the show almost exactly a year ago as a preview to last year's Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. What you been up to the last 12 months?
Well, my big new gig is I'm teaching as an adjunct faculty member at Hillsdale College. Teaching jazz piano.
Exciting.
And playing
great.
In the faculty group called the Hillcats. So that's been exciting. I love working with college students. It's they're like sponges, you know. They just take in everything. And of course still trying to, you know, play as many gigs as I can. Fortunate to have met Hank and in on the Marshall Music thing, and just keeping busy, doing a lot of different things musically.
You released an album, Timeless,
yes.
with your trio back in 2009. Any plans for another one?
Well, not at this time. I'd really
too busy
love
teaching.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's not out of the realm of possibility. So,
you gigged with Styx and a few of the guys from Styx, Hank Horton. How did you connect with those guys?
Well, that's a funny story. Back in the mid-80s, I was in grad school at State, and I was working at Marshall Music selling guitars. And a friend of mine who I'd played with called me from Chicago, and he and I had been in a band together doing cover tunes, and I used to sing Styx tunes. And he did an album with Dennis, and he called me up. He said, "How'd you like a gig with Dennis DeYoung?" And I said, "Sure, have him call me." So he called me one day at Marshall Music when I was selling guitars and said, "Why don't you come down this Sunday and I'm putting a band together, you know, doing some solo stuff." I said, "Cool." So I went down played with the band, and it wasn't really an audition. I already had the gig, but I didn't know it because he heard me on a tape singing some Styx songs and playing bass. And then he said, okay, here's what's happening. Next Friday, we're flying to L.A., and we're going to tape Solid Gold. So I'd been in the band for 6 days, and I flew to L.A. and was on Solid Gold, if
you
remember.
The TV show.
Yeah, the
sure.
TV show, yep. And then I toured with him for 23 years and played with J.Y. and played on the Styx Brave New World album.
James Young, yeah.
The guitarist, yeah.
Well, remind our listeners about the Friday gigs here at Marshall Music.
Yeah, Friday from noon to 1, we're supplying free jazz. We set up tables and chairs. When the weather is good, we have it outside. We have a tent set up. We have partnered with a lot of restaurants in the area. I've personally been around and told them all about it. We have menus and coupons. People can bring their lunch or pick up lunch on the way. They can order lunch from there and have it delivered. And it's every Friday, except July 4th because we're closed. And it's inside or outside, rain or shine. We have a big recital hall inside. In fact, today we might have it there because the weather is, you know, a little iffy at this point.
Understood. Rain or shine, it happens one place or another.
Rain or shine, and through the summer and hopefully through the fall and winter.
Okay, very good. We'll let you guys reassume your positions. They are going to be leaving us with the sounds of Horace Silver coming up here in just a minute. I want to remind all of our Current State listeners that we are nearing the end of our fiscal year. If you are a regular Current State listener and you want to strengthen the quality of our programs and make sure that we stay at it and continue the work that we're doing here on Current State, now is a time to make an investment in it. Your tax-deductible gift to Current State will guarantee that we continue, and we're prepared to bring you more quality programming here on Current State. It's time for Song for My Father from Horace Silver. It's the Friday Jazz Lunch Bunch on Current State.